Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast, the inside story, how the IIC's connectivity framework guides IIoT connectivity selection. I'm your moderator, Brandon Lewis, with today's speakers, Dr. Stan Schneider and Dr. Rajiv Joshi, both of Real Time Innovations. I'll start by introducing our speakers, the first of whom is Dr. Stan Schneider, CEO of Real Time Innovations, the industrial Internet of Things connectivity platform company. RTI is the largest embedded middleware vendor and has an extensive footprint in all areas of the industrial internet, including energy, medical, automotive, transportation, defense, and industrial control. Stan completed his PhD in electrical engineering and computer science at Stanford University and holds a bachelor's and master's of science from the University of Michigan. He is also a graduate of Stanford's Advanced Management College. Our second speaker today is Dr. Rajiv Joshi, Principal Solutions Architect at Real Time Innovations and co-chair of the Connectivity Task Group for the Industrial Internet Consortium. Rajiv is the lead author of the IIC's Connectivity Framework, a co-author of the IIC's Industrial Internet Reference Architecture, the primary author of a book on sensor data fusion, and has over 30 publications. He is also the co-inventor of 9 patents and the co-developer of RTI's flagship product, the Connects DDS Databus. Dr. Joshi is a technical contributor to the Open Connectivity Foundation, the Joint Task Force on Network Media, and various open source projects. He holds a doctorate in computer and systems engineering from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Dr. Joshi's doctoral work on data fusion applied to robotics and computer vision was awarded the best thesis at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and also the best paper at the IEEE's Multisensor Fusion Conference. Now to address a few housekeeping items. Today's schedule consists of approximately 50 minutes of presentation, leaving about 10 minutes at the end for audience Q&A. Your viewing console consists of a set of windows that you can close, open, move, resize, and maximize to your personal preference. On entry, you'll see a picture of our presenters in the presenter window, a biography in the speaker bio window, the presentation slides in the slides window, and a Q&A window that enables you to ask a question during the event. When using the Q&A window, simply type questions into the Ask a Question text box and then hit Submit. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the event and we'll address as many of these as possible during the closing Q&A. Also, if you have questions around tech support, feel free to submit those and one of our technicians will be happy to assist you. Another important item of note is the set of 7 icons across the bottom of your screen. Clicking the icon on the far left will reset your viewing area to the default configuration, and the rest of the icons will open or close a corresponding window. You can hover your mouse over each window to show all the controls, and of each of these, perhaps the most pertinent is the handout icon, third from the right. That opens a handout window with the presenter's slides in PDF format so you can download those or follow along with a hard copy. A final note before we begin is that all Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded without prior permission. So at this point, we can get started, and I'd like to hand it off to Dr. Stan Schneider of Real Time Innovations. Stan, take it away.
Hi, thanks, Brandon. It's great to be here today. Rajiv had such an impressive bio. Maybe I need to update mine, but we are very much involved in this organization called the IIC, the Industrial Internet Consortium. It is the largest of the alphabet soup of IoT consortia out there and focuses on industrial systems. I'm actually on the steering committee, who's like the board of directors, and Rajiv is our technical whiz working on many things, but in particular today, this concept of connectivity. So we're going to give you an overview of that. I'd like to start out with the big picture, and this is about the biggest picture I could come up with. So that's the big picture. This is a galaxy with the inspiring name of NGC 3220, I think. It's named NGC 3220 because there's thousands upon thousands of galaxies, in fact, 100 billion galaxies. In fact, the really inspiring picture statement about this picture, all the little dots that aren't the big galaxy in the middle are also galaxies. There are thousands of galaxies in that picture. And my point is, maybe best stated by Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, space is big. It's really big. It's mind-boggling, really, how big it is. I love that statement. And you know, you think it might be easy to do something or easy to separate things like your house to the chemist, but it's really just not that much to space. And why do I talk about that? Because we've now had many technical people, architects, proponents of different standards and protocols and application areas really dig into connectivity for the industrial internet. And our conclusion really is the industrial internet is big. It's really big. It's so big that, you know, any simple statement about it sort of defies reality. It will have a multi-trillion-dollar impact across all industries. The industrial net of things is projected to have a bigger impact than the internet, mobile phone industry. You know, basically everything you think of today is a hot industry combined. It's really a large world. I just want to be clear that we are talking about the industrial internet of things, not consumer internet of things, consumer internet of things, things like thermostats and soccer balls that know when you kick them and wearables. Industrial internet is very different. It's really about a new infrastructure for the way the planet works. It has many, many more connections, much more complexity involved in it. You know, and World Economic Forum says that 80% of the hype is on the consumer internet of things, but at least 80% of the value, that trillion-dollar impact, is over on the industrial side, changing the way the world works. It's certainly a huge trend out there is the smart machine era. It's really changing the way everything works today. Gartner calls it the most disruptive era in the history of IT, which is the most disruptive technology in the history of technology, and certainly the most disruptive thing that's ever happened to the planet. It's really an amazing disruption and change in the world, and the disruption is really across industries. You know, the real value is allowing all these different industries to connect together into a real internet. I'm a fan of the internet part of the Internet of Things, where you're really trying to build a common architecture that connects sensor to cloud, interoperates between vendors, and spans industries. Even if your application is only within one industry, having an architecture that can be used in many industries, having technology like Ethernet or Linux or things like that have just become part of many, many industries, really drives down costs and brings up capability. Our little new saying is RTI lives at the intersection of functional artificial intelligence, which is the smart machine part, and pervasive networking, which is the Internet of Things part. But we're trying to take intelligent systems and make them work in the real world. Just give you a couple of few real examples. This is GE Healthcare's, it's known as the CCS division. They have 300 different types of products you'd see in a hospital, oximeters and ventilators and respirators and ECG monitors and incubators and on and on and on. Today, they're all independent devices. The future, the problem with independent devices is none of those devices are smart enough to actually take any action and do anything really intelligently. They don't even know they're connected to the same patient. And with a little bit of effort and adding some intelligence into the system, you can connect these things together and have a distributed intelligent system that's really part of the care team. Strikingly, the third leading cause of death in the United States is actually errors made in hospitals. Most of those can be prevented or mitigated by intelligent machines that are watching patients 24/7. The problem is it's really a difficult connectivity problem. The little graph at the bottom is a simulation we ran for GE that shows actually only about 300 rooms and about 10 devices per room. So there's about 3,000 devices there. Their design criteria is 200,000 devices in a hospital because the number of devices is exploding. And the real challenge there is actually finding the information, having guaranteed that your algorithms, if, for instance, are looking at a heart waveform, actually get the data. They find patients that move, 61% of patients move in hospitals every day. It's a huge connectivity and IT challenge, and very representative of the kinds of data science challenges in the new industrial Internet of Things. Most importantly, for a disruption point of view in the industry, what's really going on is the medical industry which has forever competed on physiological parameters and ease of use for doctors, is now facing a new reality of having to compete on networking. A very different world, very software-driven world. This is actually a diagram for a self-driving car. I don't like the term self-driving car. That'll last about as long as a horseless carriage. As soon as the technology is proven, I call them carbots. So a carbot is really a robot on wheels. We have many seminars on that, webinars on that if you'd like to go see it. But this is actually a simple, very simplified diagram with sensor fusion at the bottom here, sensors and localization, which is figuring out where you are in, on the road. And then, you know, you have to sort of have the intelligent parts. Those are already intelligent, but things like, you know, what's the situation I'm approaching here and what am I going to do about it, planning, how am I going to go through it, vehicle control, logging, actually controlling the vehicle, talking to the cloud to get things like maps and traffic information. It's a very complex system, very complex software, and the auto industry today is dominated by mechanical engineering and design considerations, and actually by mechanical engineering design people. And suddenly, the disruption of this industry is very similar to what I talked about in the medical industry. Cars are now really going to compete on software architecture, probably more than anything else, which is a huge change to the way the industry works. Another industry we're very active in is power generation, especially green energy. This is a new architecture called OpenFMB for integrating distributed energy resources like solar and wind and storage into the grid. It's really a huge problem as well. And again, it's a big disruption to the way things work today. And the fundamental thing that's happening here is the grid is going to compete on distributed control with intelligence, not just in the central station or in a few substations, but in all the neighborhoods and really connect things together. It's a completely different world. So the disruption, if you want to sum up the disruption in a single slide, a single phrase, I actually love one of the Valley, Silicon Valley VC's mottos here, software is eating the world, because it really is, that's the big change. And the industrial world is best summed up by Jeff Immelt's quote, if you went to bed last night as an industrial company, you're going to wake up this morning as a software and analytics company. This is General Electric saying this. You got to realize General Electric makes turbines and, you know, drilling platforms and diesel locomotives. And this is a hardcore industrial company that is realizing you're going to wake up as a software and analytics company. I stole a bit from that and modified it a bit. And basically, if you want to understand RTI and where we're going, if you went to bed last night as a software and analytics company, you're going to wake up as a networking security company because the software isn't going to do anything without the data, and you can't get the data without networking, and you're not going to trust the data without security. So we very much work with our customers to provide that level of intelligent data systems. So, you know, how can we build these things? How can we build the industrial Internet of Things systems? It's a, you know, interoperability and security and those things are really important drivers of the connectivity architecture. What I'm really most excited about, the IIC came along. It's now over 270 companies. It's in 30-plus countries. It really rolls up representatives from almost every industry. It actually, in my humble opinion, created the Industrial Internet of Things market, because before it didn't have a name. There was no place you could go and actually have a discussion. Stanford Business School definition of a market is a group of consumers with similar needs who communicate. The consumers with similar needs have been around for a while. The communication, this is the first place where you could go and have a meaningful conversation about how a CT scanner and a medical imaging system works and how that feedback control is similar to what happens in a distributed intelligent grid with storage and solar energy out in the field, and how that may apply to a feedback controller for a factory system or a autonomous car. And it really is an amazing opportunity to work with the ecosystem there. It's a huge ecosystem with really representatives of all the top technologies and some really key and brilliant people. And I am incredibly privileged to be sitting next to one of the most key and most brilliant people, who actually I'm going to brag about him a little bit, was awarded the IIC's highest award last quarter meeting, the Individual Contributor Award, Dr. Rajiv Joshi. And he got that award largely for his contributions to defining this thing. He doesn't get to brag about himself, so it's in his bio, and I'll brag about it. But the Industrial Internet Connectivity Framework, which is really the industry's first and very much only real detailed analysis of the connectivity technologies out there. It goes from very high-level architecture down to the gory details of all the different standards out there, the protocols, the connectivity frameworks, and then actually takes a journey into, I think, the hardest part of all. It doesn't just analyze them and leave the conclusions to the reader. It offers selection guidance. What should you do? How are we going to build this industrial internet, a thing that's such a complex world? And I think this is a great time to hand it over to Rajiv, if he can stop blushing.
Thank you, Stan. Hi, everyone. So this is Rajiv, and let me give you a quick preview of what this IICF, or Industrial Internet Connectivity Framework, is about. So really, in a nutshell, it's a roadmap for IoT practitioners and system architects, and it's tackling some of the fundamental questions related to IoT connectivity, such as, you know, what really should you expect from connectivity in an IoT setting? You know, what are the layers and what are the minimum expectations of a connectivity stack in an IoT context? And, you know, what it means to have connectivity core standards, what are the requirements, you know, and if you have a connectivity technology, where does it place on the connectivity stack? How should you evaluate a given connectivity technology? And if you are building a system, you're a system architect, you know, what should you expect from connectivity, and what are sort of available choices, and how do you go about picking the right connectivity technology? So it's really mapping this rich landscape of connectivity, and really depending on where you are on this landscape, everything looks different. And from your vantage point, you know, things look different, but this document takes a step back and kind of gives you the bigger picture so that you can relate different aspects of connectivity to each other. So really there are three main goals. Number one is clarity, and that's really about providing this guide map to the rich but sometimes confusing landscape of IoT connectivity. Then the second main goal is creating a stable long-term foundation for IoT interoperability that can allow us to take what we have and also, you know, allow us to move forward. Now I'll talk a little bit more about this. And then finally, it provides us guidance, which is useful, practical, and tangible, that can allow us to do requirements assessment for our systems that we are building, to do connectivity technology evaluation and selection. It isn't from the point of view of a system architect or, you know, somebody who's making technology decisions in the context of connectivity. Now, in the reference architecture, the Industrial Internet Reference Architecture, which is a pretty elaborate document laying the groundwork for IoT architectures, connectivity is defined as the infrastructure to provide communications interoperably. So what does that really mean? Right, so what we have in front of us here is an interoperability model for communication, which defines several levels of interoperability. Level 0, of course, means no interoperability, not terribly interesting. Level 1 means technical interoperability. This is kind of like, you know, when my kids make up their own game of telephone and they make their own secret language, you know, they can share some messages. You know, right now I'm speaking, you're listening, you're getting my sound signal, right? So this is really what technical interoperability means. And from an IoT perspective, what this means is that we have shared opaque data being exchanged between participants in the system. Now, for a third party to join that conversation, they may or may not be able to. And because, you know, if it's like my kids making up their own language, well, it'd be really hard for them to, you know, as parents, it's hard for us to figure out what they're really talking about. So the next level is syntactic interoperability. And this is about having shared data structures in IoT context. And really, this is about having a shared common language for us. So I'm speaking English and you're able to understand English. That's why you're able to understand me, right? So in the same context, in the same way a third party can now join the conversation, if they understand the language, they can also start to understand what we're talking about. So this is about having a common language. And in the context of IoT, this is shared data structures. The next level of interoperability is semantic interoperability, and that really has to do with, you know, even though we're using the same language and the same words, can we actually collaborate on a task? So can we actually work together? And this means that there's some additional context behind the words that allows us to interpret them unambiguously. So this is really about shared data context. And a third party can also join and help in the help with a task. So these are the three levels of interoperability that we have been defined in the literature. And let's take a little bit of a closer look at how they apply in the context of connectivity. So here's an example, you know, being a system architect, I pulled out my toolbox and I said, okay, let's, and many have over the years since, you know, have asked me for a specific example. So this is showing two participants, one on the left, one on the right, shown as these gears or wheels. So these are agents or, you know, participants in the system. They are communicating and they're exchanging messages. And really what the connectivity infrastructure is doing is providing support for exchange of messages. Now, these messages are opaque data, which means they are just byte sequences, and you see this byte sequence up here above the arrow. And on the right, you see an ASCII version where the dots are showing the non-printable characters. Right? So if this is all that the connectivity infrastructure provides, then we would say that the connectivity infrastructure provides technical interoperability and no more. And this level of interoperability is actually sufficient for human communication. And it is so because the producers of information are humans and the consumers of information are humans. Right? So our telephone system works this way. So does the World Wide Web. The web pages or content is created by humans for consumption by humans. Right? So this approach is sufficient for human communication. But the question now is, you know, is this really the right level of abstraction for the IoT, for the Industrial Internet of Things, right? Or do we need something more? Because as we start taking the human intelligence out of the communication, you know, where does that get supplemented? And does the connectivity infrastructure need to get smarter and provide a little bit more intelligence, a little bit higher level of abstraction? So let's look at the next one. And this is syntactic interoperability. Here, the connectivity infrastructure is actually maintaining some additional information or context about the messages being exchanged. So here I'm showing a diagram that is showing a trace of structured data being exchanged. So that opaque byte sequence was actually a data structure which had three fields. It had a field called color, which was a string with a capacity of 128 characters. It had two fields, X and Y. They happened to be numbers, and they were represented as longs. So this is now the connectivity infrastructure can tell us now that, hey, look, we are exchanging structured data, and this is what it means to provide syntactic interoperability at a level of connectivity infrastructure. And this allows a third party to now participate in the conversation, at least to the point of having that shared data structure being available to them unambiguously. All right, so what's the next level? So the next level is, what is the context of this data structure? What does it really mean? You know, does that shared data structure, is the context that of a car, and the color field represents the color of my car, and the X and the Y fields represent the row and the column in the parking lot where I park my car, or does that structure represent my room, and the color represent my room color, and the X and Y represent the temperature and humidity of the room? So that is context that, again, needs to be provided by someone or some infrastructure service so that we can then unambiguously interpret that data in appropriate context if you're now collaborating on a task where this data needs to be interpreted meaningfully. So this is semantic interoperability. So now, you know, we looked at the three levels. Technical interoperability is about exchanging messages or opaque data. Data, syntactic interoperability, which is about exchanging structured data. And then semantic interoperability, which is about sharing data in context. Now, where do we draw the line? So if we look at, you know, what should we expect from the connectivity stack? So if we look at the state of the art, we draw the line right exactly at the level of syntactic interoperability. That level is pretty well established at this point. There are lots of connectivity standards and technologies that actually provide that level of capability. And if we look at semantic interoperability, that's still in R&D and that's still emerging. So there's other activity going on in IIC that's looking at that. But for the purposes of what is the minimum expectation of a connectivity stack, the IICF says the minimum expectation is that of having syntactic interoperability between the participants. And once you have that, it gives you the foundation for building high-level capabilities such as semantics and then analytics and so on top of that, and really building intelligent systems of the kind that Stan mentioned earlier. So we looked at sort of the evolution of the connectivity stack, and we looked at some of the models that have been around for a while, and, you know, obviously inspired by the, you know, which led to the Internet of People. So there's the four-layer Internet stack model, which has been around since 1989. There's the seven-layer OSI stack model that's been around since 1994. Then we looked at IoT considerations and then came up with this industrial Internet connectivity stack model. And this is being published for the first time in this IICF document from the IIC that was just released. Let's take a look at the layers of this connectivity stack model. Now, the way this picture is drawn, there's a participant X on the left side, and then there's a participant Y on the right side. And so we are seeing the layers and the levels of communication between the different layers of the connectivity stack between these two participants. So let's go bottom up. At the bottom is the physical layer, which is exchanging bits. This is the signaling layer, the ones and the zeros using whatever medium that's connecting the physical sides of the two participants. Then there's the link layer, which is usually tightly coupled to the physical layer. And so the physical and link are often called an access technology. And here the bits are organized into frames. So a frame is a sequence of bits that's being exchanged between the participants. Then the next layer is a networking layer where frames are getting organized into packets, and these packets can now go between different access technologies, and we form an inter-network. And so these bottom three layers are common to the OSI and the Internet stack, and often also referred to as a networking layer, and this is generally relatively well understood. Now, the next layer on top of this is the transport layer, and this is about exchanging messages or byte sequences or byte streams. And this is what we just looked at as part of the technical interoperability layer. So this is the transport layer. And then above that is the framework layer. And this is about where messages get organized into structured data. And the structured data could represent state, it could represent events, it could represent streams. And this layer is providing syntactic interoperability or shared data structures. And then above that is our semantic interoperability layer. So we draw the line right at the layer of the framework layer, and that's really where a lot of the focus of the IICF is. So let's take a look at these layers above the network layer. The network layer, of course, is shown as the neck of the stack because there's innovation, you know, that allows us to have innovation below the network layer, and then our focus is here on the innovation above. So the transport layer is providing technical interoperability to the layers above, by providing sharing of messages or byte sequences, and the data is opaque at the level of this layer. But this layer can provide this capability on any compute platform and can optimize the sharing of the messages, the byte sequences. Let's take a look at some of the core functions of this layer. And again, these are defined in detail in the IICF document. It goes into also the typical considerations, the trade-offs, and the different sort of design choices for each of these different boxes. So, of course, the first one is the messaging protocol. Then the next one is communication modes, unicast, multicast, broadcast, and so on. You need some notion of endpoint addressing. You need some notion of connectedness, you know, whether a session is established or not, prioritization of messages, some notion of timing and synchronization of between messages, or and then security at the level of messages. So this is really what the transport layer is about. And again, this is described in a fair amount of detail in the document. The next layer, building on top of this, is the connectivity framework layer. And this one, to the layers above it, is providing the ability to provide sharing of structured data types in a common and unambiguous data format. And below that is essentially the transport layer and so on. And this layer should provide the sharing of structured data types really in any programming environment or on any compute platform. And this layer can, again, observe the sharing of structured data flows and optimize that delivery in the context of the connectivity infrastructure. So what are some of the core functions here and typical considerations? Again, the document goes into quite a bit of detail, but at the core of it, of providing syntactic interoperability, is this notion of a data resource model. This is basically what binds everything together and creates this notion of a data object that can be shared between participants. And part of that, and so that requires having some way of identifying data objects and addressing them. It requires some way of having describing the structures or data type system, some way of managing the lifecycle of data objects, shown as CRUD, create, read, update, and delete, and then some notion of state management, for example, how much history we keep, how much, if we get disconnected and reconnected, how much state we synchronize, and so on. Now, the aspects of state management are governed by what we would call quality of service. And again, the document goes into a number of different quality of service properties that are to be expected from connectivity framework. And then you can also tie security around the data object. So again, that is part of the resource model configuration. And then you can interact with the data objects using a number of different interaction patterns. The common ones we see in the industrial IoT space are publish, subscribe, and request, apply. And then there needs to be some means of doing discovery of data objects, some means of handling exceptions when, for example, there's a disconnect or there's state management requirements that cannot be met by the connectivity framework for various reasons, quality of service exceptions, and so on. And then finally, you need some way of interacting with the framework, so an API appropriate to the programming environment, and some way of providing governance for the quality of service and the security policies. All right, so now we have looked at the connectivity stack, and we have set the minimum expectation as providing syntactic interoperability. How do we now use that as the basis of moving forward and creating a foundation for being able to embrace the old and the new? So if you step back and look at what's been holding the industry back, we see that, there are a number of brownfield technologies that have been existing for years, for the last 20, 30 years in specific verticals, and there are new emerging technologies. And so we have to accept the reality that there will be multiple technologies. Now, many folks, have been involved in the IIC from the very early days. Many folks have been telling me that this is really sort of what has been holding us back. So let's look at what this means. So here's an example of a blue connectivity technology. Here you see these circles. These are participants that are communicating over a blue connectivity technology. And I'm not being very specific here exactly what it means, but just they are connected. So blue participants can share information with blue participants. Then here's a red connectivity technology where, the reds can share information with the red participants. And if you want to open up the data between the red and the blue, we need to build a custom bridge between those two. So far we can do that and that works. But now if we add another connectivity technology into the mix, and that might be a domain-specific technology, now we have to build two bridges if we want to open up the data sharing between these different participants. And then if we want to add, have another technology, which is again domain specific. Now we have to build six bridges and so on. So you see that this becomes a parabolic curve, and essentially as the number of connectivity technologies grows up, this essentially becomes a very impractical way to go. And many have commented this has been holding us back in the industry. So how do we create an architecture that allows us as an industry to move forward and have a stable long-term architecture? So this is where the ISEF introduces the notion of connectivity core standards. The idea here is that we have a few core standards. They're shown in the middle here that provide syntactic interoperability. And, these should be standards that are stable, deployed, and open. And there can be multiple of these. And if there are multiple of these being used in the system, there should be standardized core gateways between them. Those are shown as these black octagons here in this picture. And then domain-specific technologies can connect via gateway to any of these connectivity core standards. And if we are able to do that, and if you do the analysis, the IICF document goes into a great amount of detail here, we show that the problem can be reduced from an N-squared to a linear problem. So essentially it becomes quite tractable, and it becomes a practical way to move the industry forward and advance from what's been holding us back. All right. So now we have looked at sort of a reference architecture model as well. How do we put all these things together, and how do you go about selecting the right connectivity technology? So in the document, again, in the IICF, we've put together assessment templates because if you look at a connectivity standard or connectivity technology, it may not fit the reference model exactly, right? A particular connectivity technology may span multiple layers. So yeah, so this is a way of looking at and understanding the questions such as, you know, what layers of the connectivity stack does a particular technology provide? What core functions does it provide? You know, does it not implement certain functions? And that's possible because different standards or technologies may make different trade-offs. And again, they may, you know, for each different core function, as is described in the document, there are different considerations. And different technologies may prioritize them differently. So how does it rank against those typical considerations? And what is the impact on system architectural qualities overall? And then finally, how does it fit the connectivity core standards criteria, which is also defined in the document? So these assessment templates are very detailed worksheets. They're organized around the Industrial Internet Reference Architecture viewpoints. So there's worksheets on the business viewpoint. There's worksheets for the usage viewpoint, functional viewpoints, and implementation viewpoints. And they go into detail and look at it, look at the technology from all these different viewpoints and go into quite a bit of detail, bringing together the core functions and the typical considerations and give us essentially an assessment worksheet. These are 4 pages long to evaluate any connectivity technology. Now, these worksheets can be used also for your system architecture requirement determination. Now, in the document, and again, from the membership, we have built a catalog, a starter catalog of connectivity standards. And this starter catalog includes three connectivity framework standards, DDS, OPC-UA, 1M2M. And it also includes three transport connectivity, transport standards, HTTP, MQTT, and COAP. So these are, again, described in detail in the document, and essentially using the same objective worksheet so that one can compare using sort of the same lens, the same reference model, different connectivity standards. Where do these fit on the connectivity stack? So this slide, again, is from the IICF, shows a roll-up of how do these different technologies place on the connectivity stack. Let's go bottom-up. So at the bottom-up, you know, while we didn't spend a lot of time going into detailed assessments of the layers below the network layer, we wanted to recognize some of the ones that the membership felt were relevant for this space. So you see things like TSN and so on. You see different wireless and wire technologies. The network layer is the core standard for the IP protocol is the core standard for the network layer. So we sort of use that as a starting point, and that allows us to have innovation below the IP layer. Now, above the IP layer, we have the usual suspects, the TCP IP stack, right, the TCP transport and the UDP transport. And then you start to see more specialized transports that you hear more about in the IoT space. So there's the COAP, there's MQTT, and then there's HTTP. The HTTP, of course, is the one for the World Wide Web. MQTT is usually used for telemetry, and then COAP is for, resource-constrained devices. Those are transports, and they really just provide technical interoperability. Now, above that is connectivity framework standards. So we have DDS, and as you notice in this diagram, DDS actually defines its own connectivity transport layer standard as well, called DDSI RTPS. And that can be optimized to run over UDP for low latency, real-time communications for building real-time applications. And it can be optimized to run over TCP for wide area networks and wide area communications. Then there's OPC-UA, which comes from the manufacturing origin. And that one defines its own transport standard as well, called OPC-UA BIN. That is optimized to run over TCP. And it also can run over HTTP and use HTTP as a transport. Then you see 1M2M, which comes from the telecommunications space. And that actually is more of a framework layer and higher. It doesn't actually provide its own connectivity standard. Instead, it can use any of the connectivity transport standards available, such as COAP or MQTT or HTTP. And finally, there's web services, which is, not a specific connectivity framework standard, but really refers to the collection of connectivity frameworks that people typically build, often bespoke on top of HTTP transport, typically using a RESTful architecture. So we also then took these potential core connectivity standards, DDS, web services, OPC UEN 1 and 2M, and stacked them against the core standard criterion so that we could evaluate how they stack against the criteria. So you can see the summary here. What's interesting to note is that there are gateways to web services. I'm looking at line number 5 here from all of them. And then there are gateways between, we've been demonstrating gateways between DDS and OPC UA. And then there are gateways emerging for 1M2M and DDS and 1M2M and OPC UA. So this is quite interesting. You also see that some of these are in development, some aspects for these standard design development. Some are relatively new. Some have been stable and been around for a while. All right. So how do we go about picking a connectivity standard? How do we go about applying all of this work for our systems that we are trying to build? So you can approach it in 3 steps. The first step is to use the connectivity assessment template worksheets to determine your system requirements. Once you have that, then the next step is to pick essentially a potential core connectivity standard that's best aligned to your system requirements. And again, you can use the worksheets that are already built up, the starter catalog, to make this assessment. And finally, if there are connectivity technologies that are domain-specific, you can build gateways for that connectivity core standard. So that's the process in a nutshell. I'm going to hand it over to Stan, and Stan is going to talk a little bit more about choosing a connectivity standard.
Great. Thanks, Rajiv. That was wonderful. So, Rajiv showed an architecture for putting together all these connectivity standards in a long-term stable format, but your job when you start out is to figure out, where do you start? You're building a system, you need usually a single core connectivity standard or a single connectivity standard to get going. And a couple of years ago, I wrote a paper and did some webinars and things on the idea that you could take standards, and I'll for instance, take the red one here that we call A, and map it into the requirements that it satisfied, in this case, latency and fan out. I actually had 10 requirements, but I can't show a 10-dimensional graph without drugs. So we're just showing one here. But the idea was you take the standards that are your options, and you map them out, A, B, and C here, red, blue, and green, and then you take your application and figure out where it fits on this. And here it fits in sort of, the middle of B and okay in A and C. And now you can choose A, B, or C based on your application. That was, a useful perception. And then we had this almost 3-year-long process of talking to all the other connectivity standards and really understanding how they work. And I no longer believe this is true. I think space is big and the reality looks more like that. They virtually don't overlap. There are some applications that live smack in the middle of one of the technologies or others, but there's others that are, usually they're close, or your application here is closest to B, so you should use B. It's the best you're going to get. But sometimes you get stuck out in interstellar space, and then you're sort of on your own because nothing really works for you, and you've got to figure out what you're going to do. And so, the really hard problem with all the experts that we did is we put our technologies into boxes. And here's the boxes. And I think the most exciting thing about this is the different standards all walked away saying, we got the biggest box. Because they're so different that they don't even speak the same language, and I'll be very crisp about that later. So DDS, which is data center technology, I'm going to go through these very quickly with the time we have, really end up targeting software integration and autonomy. Not together, but software, large software systems and autonomous systems, which are also large software systems. And the real users out there typically have titles like software architect or system architect, and they're integrating components themselves into a system. OPC-UA is very much more device-centric. It really targets device interchangeability. It also provides things like access to the data for HMIs and historians, but you know, the fundamental thing that it really is trying to do is build device models and allowing you to have access to the devices and build work cells out of the devices. An example user is a device manufacturer selling devices to technicians or industrial engineers, and the users are not big software teams. Web services, HTTP, RESTful approach is, really not nearly as real time, and, you know, many applications for it, not as many of them actually building, executing real time systems, really application builders trying to connect to back end services. Again, it's a different kind of thing. And 1MTM, really does ICT integration, which is, information and communications technology. It's really about telecom providers and wireless services and things like that, with a very different approach that they call a common services layer. And the users are drastically different. I'll come back to that in a second. So I'm going to go through the fundamental goals of the technologies here quickly. First of all, DDS is a standard that targets, data centricity. I mean, there's very different than the others in a lot of ways because all the other technologies take data and put it into something called a message typically and then send that message somewhere and they may send it to a different entity point to point and they may send it to a server and the server sends it to other people and they may send it to other entities that have asked for it, publish, subscribe, or send it to a queue that then sends it to other entities. But the point is the interaction is between entities, between servers and clients or peers or something, not between the data and the entity. DDS is quite different. The interaction has no concept of messages. You actually, as a user, you're writing an application that talks to the data infrastructure itself. It's data-centric. And actually, everybody's familiar with the data-centric technology in the storage world called a database. A database is an entity that allows you to store old and search old data. But the key thing is up in the right upper right corner here. In a data-centric technology, your application has a relationship with the data, not with another application. So in a database case, you know, if you're going to write a parts management system for a auto parts store, and you write an application that can access that database, there may be many, many other applications all over the world that are updating that database and changing it, but you don't have any relationship with them. You have a relationship just with the database. DDS is the same kind of thing, except we call it a data bus. You talk to the data in the future, so you can set filtering requirements to say things like, I need, in this wind power example here, I need updates from any turbine that has a phase variance that's too big. In the medical case I started with at GE, I need to have guaranteed access to the heart waveform of Rajiv Joshi so I can make sure he's not going to have a heart attack because his CEO did something crazy. It's a world that you need to, it's a world of difference that it works, and the data bus can guarantee things that other kinds of things don't really guarantee, such as actual connectivity with sensors. So if you've got 480 wind turbines, it can guarantee it actually is in contact with all 480 of them, so you have to ping them. It can guarantee that it can stream data in a hard waveform thing at 100 hertz. Not 50 hertz because your algorithm won't work and not 1,000 hertz because that would flood you. It actually does flow rate control and all those kinds of things that the data structure does itself to allow all these applications to work just with the data. It's an interesting concept and very freeing, just like a database allows you to build very large enterprise systems, enterprise software systems. A data bus allows you to build very large enterprise industrial Internet of Things systems. But even that is confusing. It just tells you what it does and not if you should use it. So we've distilled it down in five questions. And the nice thing about these questions you don't need to know what a data bus is, and I don't need to know what you do. So if you're listening to this, you can answer this question and decide if you live there. And the first question, what happens if you go offline for a few minutes or seconds or milliseconds? Because the data bus has no servers, there's no servers to reboot. So if you can't survive a server rebooting or you can't deal with being offline for a little while, then check that box. And you know, a thermostat, who cares if it's offline for a few minutes? Even in typical factory application, a lot of them, you know, if it goes down, it's not a disaster. But if you're building an autonomous car that's going to drive down the freeway at 170 miles an hour next to other cars, you can't go offline for a few seconds. You'd crash. If you're building a medical imaging system or a medical treatment system that has to take good care of patients, you can't go offline. If you're building a It sort of came from the combat management system in the military or a power system. You're going to lose the power grid. That's a big problem. So that's the first one. Check that box. Next one, very simple language. Have you said the word millisecond or microsecond in the last 2 weeks? Because that's a definition of real time. Third one, do you have more than 10 programmers? It really targets software engineers. You have to have 10 people. You check that box. Does your data have many destinations opposed to all going to the cloud or all going to a historian or something? Are you actually trying to share data between different destinations? Check that box. And finally, really, are you building something new rather than optimizing something old? Yes, it's not. It's a new architecture. It's not designed as a – you can do a retrofit, but a retrofit is you're going to rip out everything and build a whole new architecture and then migrate your old system to it. Anyhow, if you check three of those five, then you would live smack in the middle of the little DDS box. If I've checked all five, you're really in the middle. But if you're three, you're comfortably inside the DDS space, and you should choose DDS. If you didn't choose it, then you're outside. You two of the three, you know, you're probably close but not quite in it. And if you only checked one or zero, you shouldn't pick DDS. It doesn't fit you, probably. OBCUA, device-centric, object-oriented, completely different. Object-oriented, data-centric are direct opposites. Object-oriented's mantra is encapsulate data and expose methods. Data-centric's mantra is encapsulate methods. You have no user-written methods and expose data and data properties. So it's really completely different approach, completely different design. It really targets generic device models, integrating devices into work cells, the client-server architecture. You can build an address space of all these devices and find them so you can have an HMI connect to it. It has a new UDP publish subscribe, which some people confuse with DDS because it sort of comes from the other side, but data centricity is not about pattern. RTI, for instance, supports publish subscribe, request reply, which is sort of client-server, although there's no clients and servers. It's a relationship with the data, and even queuing. It's not about patterns. It's about who you have a relationship with. Anyhow, I have questions for OPCUA too, which you know, simplifies things. Are you in discrete manufacturing? If you're in discrete manufacturing, OPCUA has a lot of traction there. The German Industry 4.0 is you know, hard over on OPCUA. It's a very safe choice there. If you're building a device that is going to be integrated by non-software people, and later if they're going to be integrated by industrial engineers or technicians, and your customers aren't really sophisticated software, check that box. If you're building a product of any type that is going to be used in different systems, so you don't really control the system architecture, you just control this device that's going into the system architecture, check that box. And then in the language category, have you said the word work cell in the last 2 weeks? Because most, not all, but most OPCUA users think of their world as building work cells, and virtually no DDS or 1M2M users think or talk about work cells. It's that stark of a difference. If you talk about work cells, then you check that box. And if you checked at least three of these boxes, then you're pretty cleanly in the middle of the OPCUA space, and you only check two or one, you're not. There's zero, you're not. 1M2M. Completely different architecture. The whole idea is they have common service layer that a telco can provide, you know, your cell phone provider. And then you can have platform tier, it's another term from IIC, cloud applications that can connect to the different devices over many protocols. It really targets home automation, large mobile systems, and does things like register and connect, charge an account, manage applications and devices, monitor systems. It's all about this common service layer architecture. And if you think about that for a little bit, you'll see that it's completely different kind of questions. First of all, they're in the ICT industry. I said it earlier, I'm not going to say it again now, but if you don't know what ICT stands for, you do not check that box. If you do and you think it's what you're doing, then check that box. Is the cellular network your primary connection technology? It's important because this is about services of the cellular network. Are your target applications largely composed of moving things, which is what cellular really allows? Even though 5G will come along and make things less intermittent, it's still you have to be able to survive a transition, intermittent connections and loosely controlled latencies. It's required. And will your system leverage services provided by a telco provider? Because it's a common service architecture. Without those, there's no reason to do that. So if you check 3 of 5 of those, you belong in one M2M. If not, you don't. I threw in MQTT here because it's very well known. It's not really a core connectivity technology that doesn't have standard type system, so it doesn't have some syntactic interoperability. But still, if you look at that, MQTT is really about data collection. Do you think of your application data collection? Is there very little device-to-device communication that's really not optimized for that? Because it has no syntactic interoperability, you better not be trying to build something interoperable between something else that you don't control. Do you have lots of small devices? It's good for that. And software, it doesn't have a lot of software integration power, but if it's a minor problem compared to installing the sensors or accessing things or something like that, then check that box. If you check 3 of those, you belong in MQTT space. If you didn't check 3 boxes in any of these questions, unfortunately, you are in interstellar space, and I can't help you today. We can talk to you about it, but you are in interstellar space, and the world is huge. This is a... there's lots of galaxies out there. So, finally, message, the IoT space is big, is really big. You will not believe how mind-bogglingly big it is. And you may think you can pick DDS or OPC or MQTT or whatever, and it won't really matter. I think after this analysis, we can comfortably tell you it does matter. You really need to understand the differences and choose the best fit, or you're going to build a lot of effort. You're going to be a little world of hurt. So I'll finish with John Chambers, my favorite quote: "You don't compete against competitors; you compete at market transitions." And this is the largest market transition in the history of mankind. And I will strongly recommend you go down to the IIC site and download this document, and you'll understand much more. It's a dense document. We're trying to make it more accessible in your contact in your download of the slide. You have lots of contact information for both Rajiv and I, and thank you very much. I'm running out of time.
Thanks, Dan. So we're about out of time, but we've got time for a couple questions here. And one is for Rajiv. Given the number of standards that are mentioned here, how is the IIC's connectivity framework actually going to help accelerate rather than hinder adoption of industrial IoT?
Thanks, Brendan. Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, so, first of all, the IICF defines a common nomenclature and a common vocabulary for connectivity in this space, in industrial IoT. And it's really, clarifying that connectivity stack and clarifying the functions of the framework. It's setting the minimum expectations of what is to be expected from IoT connectivity. So hopefully, that will be a firm foundation on which we can start building higher level concepts. Too often we see everybody starts from scratch and repeats the same cycle. And this is, hopefully will help minimize the confusion and accelerate the market, right? Because this now establishes a beacon for the industry, defining the minimum expectations for a core connectivity standard for IoT. And then, IoT solution providers, platform providers, connectivity technology providers, and standards development organizations who are working in the connectivity space, they can use this common industry-wide nomenclature and foundation and the definition of the connectivity stack for IoT to explain what they are doing, to identify gaps in what they are doing, and really, get everybody sort of building on the same common foundation. And we need that very much. And quite urgently, frankly, from what I've received as feedback from people, at least in the IRC membership. And then, you know, there's guidance in here that, you know, really isn't the means of a tool, right? Those worksheets give people a tool so they can assess their own system requirements and then try to see which potential connectivity standard best aligns with what they are trying to build, right? And so hopefully this will also promote an ecosystem where we start to see more gateways coming out for the core, you know, potential core connectivity standards. And again, it will help accelerate the market. So I think there's a lot of factors that go into it, but that's what this document enables.
Great. Unfortunately, that's about all the time we have for today. And for those of you who had questions we weren't able to get to, we'll be sure to have the appropriate representatives from Real Time Innovations follow up. I'd like to thank Dr. Stan Schneider and Rajiv Joshi of Real Time Innovations for that look at the IIC connectivity framework. And we at Open Systems Media and Real Time Innovations would also like to thank you, the audience, for attending today and contributing some good questions. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast will be made available there as well. You can do a web search with the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of Open Systems Media eCast archived there as MP3s. Thanks again for attending, and have a great day.